Martin Urbano is a stand-up comedian who is bringing that craft to Austin this weekend for Moon Tower Comedy Festival. He is performing at the State Theater on Sunday night, 7 and 9:30 shows. Not only is it stand-up, he is taping a special at the State Theater on Sunday at 7 and 9:30. You can go to austintheater.org for info and to possibly grab the tickets that remain. Martin, thank you so much for the time. How are you doing today?
Doing well. How are you doing?
I am doing great, and I have to say, I am a big lover of stand-up comedy for a lot of reasons. There's the obvious reasons, the biggest acts out there, but I love stand-up because it provides you an opportunity to really learn about some of the most important, or maybe the smartest, or maybe the darkest up-and-comers in the art form right now, and I consider you squarely in that category. You are sick, you are twisted, and it's my brand of comedy. And on top of all of that, for anybody listening in Austin right now, you're also a Texas native, too. So let's start with those Texas roots, because you have lived all over the state, starting in Brownsville, near the border. What was it like growing up as a kid in Brownsville?
That's right. Born and raised Brownsville, Texas. It was nice. I liked it, but I moved. I like to visit. I like to visit, you know?
So you mentioned that in other interviews that the first time you performed stand-up was at the age of 16 in Dallas, mm-hmm. if I'm not mistaken, in a club in a hotel in Dallas. What led to you doing stand-up there for the very first time? Because you did go back to South Texas and you were performing regularly in McCallum and elsewhere. So why Dallas as that first spot?
Man, you really did your research. Yeah, I'm forgetting about these things. No, yeah, Backdoor Comedy Club. I mean, that was just like, the first time I tried to do stand-up was at the River Center Comedy Club in San Antonio. I don't know if it's still open. I think it became like an improv. I'm not sure, but I showed up there for an open mic night, and it was like my dad had to take me. And, you know, learning about how, you know, some people could be later, I'm like, okay, I'm glad that my father was there to be around a teenager. But it was just me and a couple of other grown men. We're like, all right, no one's showed up, so we got to go bark. So they went and they were like, hey, anybody want to see an open mic night? Just like two grown men asking that. And I'm just like shy with my dad. And then the open mic got canceled. And that was when I was 16. And it was like right before my birthday. And I was like, I want for like my story in life to be like, I started at 16. Like that's, but it ended up happening. I had to wait till I was 17 and happened to be in Dallas. And we were on like some vacation. I said, hey, I really want to do stand up at this comedy club. A Backdoor Comedy Club. It was in the lobby of a hotel. And I'll tell you what, I killed it.
Did you?
I killed.
Okay. That's not always easy to do at an open mic. If anybody's ever been to an open mic before.
In my mind, I don't know. I probably like was not very good, but you know, in my mind, I remember just being like, yeah, I was on fire. Everybody loved it. And I don't know.
Well, even if you're getting a couple of laughs that very first time, it's the sort of encouragement that you need to keep trying it. So clearly you got at least a couple of laughs along the way, even if it was an open mic crowd, which oftentimes for anybody who's never been to an open mic before, it's a lot of open micers that make up the crowd and some of their friends too. So yeah. You were probably impressing some of the other aspiring comics, if nothing else.
I think so. I think there's something funny about like this like little kid saying dirty jokes, you know? And I think I just also had like so much like pent up, you know, like excitement. Like I got blue. Can I say?
Oh, you say whatever you want to. I record these so you can speak okay, how you cool. want to speak.
Okay, cool. It was like I had like blue balls from like the time of like going to my first open mic, so I was just like really pent up, and so it all just, you know, came out everywhere.
And after that, you started performing somewhat regularly in South Texas then?
Yeah, I saw the Last Comic Standing tour, and Roy Wood Jr. was on it. And I was just like trying to talk to them afterwards. They were all super duper nice. Mike Kaplan, Mike DiStefano. But Roy Wood Jr. was like, hey, there's this local guy. This is in McCallum. There's this local guy named Mario Superstar Salazar. I'll put you in touch with him. You should just, or you reach out to him and he'll like try to put you up, but he's a cool guy. I'm like, okay. So I reached out to Mario Superstar Salazar, and he gave me opportunities to go up on stage. Cena El Rey, in McAllen. That was like my first real like shows. Paradise Roadhouse, a legendarily a tough room. Yeah, in Westlico. Yeah,
Really
all
cool
over
to hear
that.
about Roy Wood Jr. By all accounts, according to those who are in comedy and are around the guy, he is just a world-class individual. I spoke with him once several years ago about the Confederate statue documentary that he was a part of. Great documentary, by the way. But he was so quick on his feet, but also incredibly generous with his time, too. So it's great to hear that he was taking the opportunity to help out somebody who was young and clearly passionate about this to continue to pursue that dream.
Truly, I nothing but nice things to say about him. And, like a couple years ago here in New York, I got to, started doing shows where he was on the lineup too. And I remember doing one show at a place called Asylum, and I had a really good set that night. It was like a couple comedians were struggling. I went up and I really killed it. And then Roy Wood Jr. came up, and I was like, oh, I didn't know the audience could even make these sounds. Like that's what killing it. I did all right. He's killing. Yeah, he's great.
So Roy's going to be a part of this year's Moon Tower Comedy Festival as well. But for those who are considering going and seeing you at the Stateside Theater on Sunday, two opportunities, a 7 and 9:30 show. What can they expect out of the current tour that you're on, which is called the Apology Comeback Show? And I think you're going to be recording this special here in a couple of months. So this is one of the last chances people actually have to see you doing this live.
Yeah, I mean, the taping is on Sunday, and I'm not gonna
Oh, the taping is actually at Moon Tower.
that's the taping, yeah, on this Sunday.
Okay.
Yeah, and after that, never gonna perform it again. So this is very much the last chance, and yeah, I'm excited to show what I've been working on kind of since like the beginning of my stand-up career till now, how it's all grown. It's very dark. Irreverent, satirical. These are words people throw about. Hard to market. That's another term people like to use. Kind of confusing. I'm playing a little bit of a character. But I think it's funny. I hope everyone likes it.
So, not to spoil too much, but you go after the idea of cancel culture from a more conservative perspective, let's say, and really mock the art form that you are a part of by essentially outing yourself as a pedophile, even though, again, it's a character, you're not really a pedophile. Sometimes people in the crowd have a hard time with that one. They have a hard time separating the art from the artist.
I like to I mean it started when I did a set on Jimmy Kimmel Live, and I talk about it a little bit in the show, but I did a bit where I called myself a sex offender, and that just sort of led me down a rabbit hole that now I've created this show, and I don't know what I've done. I don't know why I've done this. Why couldn't I just talk about normal things? But no, it's that I have a 15-minute chunk on pedophile jokes.
Yeah, you've imprisoned yourself. I've heard you talk about this in other interviews. You feel a little bit imprisoned and kind of tired of the material right now. You're tired of calling out the whole of trying to cancel the idea of cancel culture, and now you're ready to move on and do something, as I think you put it a few months ago, something that is the most marketable thing that you could possibly do on stage, right?
Yeah, I've been saying that for months now. That's funny. Yeah, I've been saying it. I've been feeling it a lot lately. This special, this was fun. This was an artistic statement. The special after is just going to be about the money.
It's going to be the sellout show, right?
Sell that show. The tentative title is One for You.
So, this is not your first time in Austin. For people who are unfamiliar, you actually lived in Austin many years ago. You lived in Denton prior to that, though. Did you go to North Texas, or did you just basically go to Denton as a jumping off point to eventually making it to the bohemian city that is Austin?
That's exactly right. It was a jumping off point. No, I was a college dropout, and I didn't really have many options. And my high school sweetheart, my girlfriend at the time, was her brother lived in Denton. I think he went to the music school there, was attending at that time. Let me crash on his couch for like $200 a month, and there's a little scene there that I could kind of go up 5 nights a week. Really do the open mics. People were nice to me. And after a couple months there, I was like, okay, there's not much more to do here. It's time to go to Austin. And then I did, made it to Austin, worked at the Target Cafe, and did open mics there. I was there
for open mics at the Target Cafe.
Yeah, I wish, man. No, it was it was an interesting time of my life. Austin comedy scene was really good for me. I learned a lot.
When were you in Austin, and how long did you stick around here before you ultimately made the move? I'm guessing to New York City.
That's right, 2013 to 2016. I moved here in 2016. Yeah.
So the big club then would have been Cap City Comedy Club at the old location, and you were probably doing spots elsewhere around town too. Whether you're talking about Esther's Follies or the Velveeta Room, or I mean, this was pre what people have come accustomed to with stand up in this town, and it was a great scene back then too. By the way, anybody who's surprised by what Austin has become shouldn't be. Austin is. Always been well known as a great comedy city with a bunch of aspiring comics who eventually do continue that grow up process and move either west to LA or east and north up to New York. And now I guess you can just stay in Austin to try and make it as a comic.
Yeah. What's the scene like now? I'm curious. I don't know what it looks like. Has it like ballooned to like twice its size would be my kind of vague understanding.
Maybe. I don't know, to quantify it is tough. I would say more than twice its size, though, because you have two world-class clubs, like comedy clubs, like 200 to 300 person clubs in Cap City and then Rogan's Place. You have some other really good spots too. Creek in the Cave is a great spot. It's I call it the CrossFit gym of comedy clubs here in town because it's a bit bare bones, but it's a great place to see shows. I've seen some killer acts there, everything from Louis C.K. to Steve Byrne to saw Tom Segura there a few weeks ago. There are a bunch of good acts who passed through town. Sean Patton is another one that I saw at Creek in the Cave. Vulcan Gas Company is very unique. It's a 2-floor setup. I don't think the second floor is great for comedy necessarily, but that lower floor is really good for that. Saw Sam Tripoli there a few months back. And then you still have things like the Velveeta Room too. And then of course, Stateside and the Paramount Theater, which is where a lot of Moon Tower occurs. It's an overwhelming amount of comedy that you can see on a given night or a given weekend. I mean, most weekends I look at the three main clubs, Rogan's Place, Cap City, and Creek in the Cave. And it's like, these are all three world-class comedians. It does feel like we're starting to see a little bit of a comedy bubble here in Austin, just because there's only so many people to go around and see these things. And yes, tourists can help fill those seats too. But at some point, you need more in the way of local participation. And I think we only have so much of that right now for a variety of reasons. But the scene is booming here. I mean, it's comics who have come into this place skeptical of what Austin has become comedy-wise have walked away believers because they see that it's really, you strip away a lot of the extra BS that you get in LA especially, and maybe New York to a lesser degree, where it's not just about the comedy, it's about getting that sitcom deal or whatever other TV deal, getting discovered for the Tonight Show, and it really is strictly about getting better at stand-up.
Totally. Interesting. Yeah, interesting to have that, you know. I mean, yeah, Austin was a really good scene, but now it has become sort of like a third, or, you know, fourth top tier comedy mecca, a goal for people to go to. And that's funny. I was looking at it like, wow, Austin at one point. And now it's like people are moving from L.A. to Austin. That's wild to me.
Well, I feel bad for some of the local comics who had started to really make names for themselves prior to the last 3 to 4 years. I mean, Andrew Murphy is one of those guys who I'm a big fan of, former funniest person in Austin winner through Cap City, and some other people like that, because it's almost like you have to hit the reset button now in a sense and reestablish yourself. And that's not to say that the years of work that you put in at this point are a complete waste, but you get reset, maybe not back to square one, but maybe to square two or three after all the new talent that has flooded in here, including a lot of established people too.
I mean, I think that's also like good for, you know, people. You can't get complacent. You got to keep hustling, keep working, keep striving.
Competition definitely begets greatness. So
I feel like I learned so much by coming to New York, you know, just being, you just, when you're around so many top tier people, you just kind of, you know, get better and get, you know, you're trying to like sink or swim, you know?
Yeah, no question. And so what ultimately spurred your move to New York in 2016? Was it as simple as you just wanting to be around other really talented individuals to push yourself to be better?
Well, yeah, I mean, I definitely wanted to move at some point because I saw Austin as like, well, I learned a lot here and then I take it to elsewhere, you know, to the big one of the two. I hadn't decided between LA or New York, but my girlfriend at the time, different than my high school sweetheart, my ex, we were doing long distance for a year while she lived in New York. And she was just like, she was doing grad school and was like, you know, I know how much you love comedy. You need to move here. This is where it's happening. And I'm like, okay. And then I did. Very simple. Just like, this is where comedy's at. I'm like, okay, that's a good point. I'll go there.
How long did it take you to find some modicum of success?
I got pretty lucky. Within my first year there, I got Just for Laughs, New Faces, and Jimmy Kimmel. I got a late night spot on Kimmel. It was like booked by the same person. It was just like luck, and she had seen me like before in Austin, and now I had just moved, and I had like a really good set that was already kind of TV ready. It was just a very lucky time, and then since then, it's still been ups and downs, but that was kind of like within the first year of moving here, I got very lucky.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, and I'm reluctant to mention this because your comedy is the exact opposite of this sort of comedy. You did write for Jimmy Fallon for about 6 months. Now, again, let me reemphasize that that Martin's comedy is much darker, twisted, and much more funny than what you'll see on Jimmy Fallon's show in a given night. But prior to that, you were toiling to a degree that you tried to reapply at Target. You end up getting rejected for some strange reason and end up working at Madame Curie's Wax Museum. Is that correct?
Yeah, Madame Tussauds Wax
Madame
Museum,
Tussauds,
Times
excuse me.
Square. Please, Madame Tussauds. No, I don't. Yeah, that was a dark time, you know. And even after, yeah, getting Kimmel and having like TV spots and like writing for TV and like having these jobs, just like kind of a post-COVID, like not really getting back fully on the road in a way, being bad with money and just like not getting exact opportunities. I just, yeah, ran out of money. I applied for Fallon, sent that off. I worked really hard on it, but then didn't hear anything back. Had to get a job. I again, college dropout, all my experiences in television or in comedy. So I'm like, what am I going to do now? So I just applied for retail jobs, including Target, and I was no longer qualified enough to work at Target. That was a real blow to the ego. And the only place that would hire me was Madame Tussauds Wax Museum, and it was me and a bunch of like it was a bunch of like teens like trying to make money on the side, like while they were like going to like while they're still in high school or like they're in college, and me, a grown man, trying to make his like rent in New York City. So it's a very like juxtaposition there. Very dark time in my life, but I realized that, you know what, I care about comedy. This is just a tough moment. This is a very humbling experience. I'm gonna just read, you know, just try really hard, head down, grind through it, do comedy on the weekends or, you know, at nights, and then like travel on the weekends and just like work this shitty job and just try to make it. I'll be in debt for a while. It's gonna be hard. And right when I made that decision, I got a call from the Tonight Show, and they were like, "Hey, do you want to come write for us?" I'm like, "Yeah, I think I can make some time. I think I can clear up my schedule."
Honest question, because I feel like anytime I see a wax museum, I just assume that it's a money laundering front. Are there actually people that go to wax museums?
It's the darndest thing. People really love taking pictures with this thing that looks like a celebrity. But one of my favorite parts is they at the end of the thing, they have these KPIs, like key performance index thing. It's just like a survey that people take. And everybody, you know, some people out of like I think a tenth of the people like just fill out the survey while they're waiting for the elevator to get the hell out of there. And every morning they would go over the numbers right before we would get the day started. They'd be like, okay, so like customer satisfaction is at 94%. You know, we want to get that up to 96%. That's kind of what we want. Customer satisfaction with the staff, you know, staff friendliness. Oh, we're at 95%. That was our goal. 95%. That's good. You know, whatever. That was our goal. 90 something percent. That was our goal. And then it was like value for money. The question, value for money, was it worth the money? They were like, okay, that was at 3%. 3% of the people thought they got good value out of the money, which is our goal. So that's like really good. Like, wait, what the hell? Like,
Oh,
three
3%.
percent of
They
the
were
people.
just looking to rip people off then.
I think so. They're like, nobody thinks it's like was worth the money. But people still go. Yeah, I remember. Maybe I'm giving away company secrets, and I'll be
I think you're going to be all right,
assassinated.
unless it really
Assassinated
is
by
a
the
money
man.
laundering front, and then they're going to come after you for talking down to the cartel, you know?
Yeah. I think it's just a thing people think, or like, that's like a thing I'm supposed to go see. And then they go and they're like, that was a lot of money for nothing. Yeah.
Oh yeah, well, I mean, look, the wax figures look in a very basic way like the celebrities that they're supposed to be imitating, but it's like seeing a statue outside of a stadium. Like, how much does it actually look like the sports figure that you idolized as a kid, you know?
Most of the people are like pretty difficult to recognize. The newest ones, The Rock does, I will say The Rock does look pretty cool. It looks like Dwayne The Rock Johnson and Bad Bunny. It's actually pretty cool now I think about it.
I don't know who Bad Bunny is. I'll take your word on that one.
You know who Bad Bunny is?
Who is Bad Bunny?
He's like a big Latino a superstar musician.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I'm out on the music. I'm out on newer music. I do have a 9 and 7 year old, so eventually that's going to be coming back around, but my head is
Yeah.
in the sand with regards to new music from the last, I don't know, 5 to 10 years now, apparently.
I mean, me too. You know, I think maybe it's also just like I'm Latino, so I'm like I'm very aware of Bad Bunny. Yeah.
That's
Because I
fair.
don't know much about music.
So obviously Fallon didn't work out in terms of what your comedy is versus what they were looking for. What was it like working for Jimmy Fallon, though?
I mean, I loved the money. That was good money. They didn't really use my ideas for obvious reasons. I think if you watch my stand-up and you watch the Tonight Show, you'd be like, yeah, why were you even working there? The notes I got back, it was like fine, but the notes I got back immediately, the first note I got back was too dark, and then immediately after, too sad. I'm like, what are these notes? I swear I'm trying my best. What do you mean too sad? Are we writing kids shows? Yeah,
Well,
it
yeah,
was
kind
bad.
of. When you watch the end result, it kind of is a kid's show, yeah.
Yeah, they had for a little while a thing called the Kids Tonight Show, which I liked referring to as the Edgy Tonight Show.
Well, it always seemed to me like Jimmy Fallon, if nothing else, had the nice guy thing going for him. But the thing that came out in Rolling Stone not too long ago suggests otherwise. Was that your experience also, that he wasn't the most pleasant person to work for?
Here's the thing. I think I was there for so little amount of time. He was always nice to me.
Okay.
In the brief interactions I've had with him, he was perfectly nice. But again, I wasn't really around for a lot of it. I got fired pretty quick, I guess, in the grand scheme of things.
Sure. What was your next step after that? I mean, were you considering quitting again just because it was such a rotten experience for you?
The second I got the job, I told my manager, get me a touring agent. I had one, but then like COVID, it kind of like dropped them, and then just didn't really have any touring agent. But I said, this is the leverage, this is the in. I just got hired at the Tonight Show. Get me a touring agent so that the second I get fired, because I know I'm going to get fired, I don't know when, but I know I will, I need to go on the road and do stand up and make a living doing that. So I just did that. As soon as I got fired, that was like the same week I got my agents, and they booked me for a bunch of stand-up gigs, and I just spent the last like year just on the road touring.
How's that been going so far?
It's been good. I've gotten to, yeah, I did some international festivals, which were a lot of fun. I got to kind of go to a bunch of different clubs and indie venues across the country.
Hey, you killed it in Edinburgh, right?
In Edinburgh, in Scotland, it was the Edinburgh Comedy Fringe Festival. It's a month-long thing where I perform my hour every single night at this big arts festival, and it went really well. It was a fun time.
So, do you feel like your stock is about to take off? Are you about to enter exit velocity here after you get to tape this first special and then move on to the more marketable stuff?
It's we'll see what happens. It's a good question. I hope so. That being said, I've definitely been at a lot of places before where I really thought I was about to skyrocket into fame, so, or success, as something sustainable. I don't know, just kind of taking it step by step. I'm excited to tape it, and I hope people like it.
That's a healthy attitude to take. So, considering that you lived here for 3 to 4 years, what are you looking forward to about coming back to Austin and hanging out for the next week?
A lot of my family is going to come out to the taping, which will be nice. I think it might be a little awkward right after.
It depends on how they take to pedophile jokes, right?
Yeah, exactly. We'll see how that works out. It'll be nice to see family and friends and just like hang out. Austin's a fun time, a fun city. I was there last year for Moon Tower. So much fun. So much fun. Yeah.
All right, and last question now. What do you love about stand-up comedy, Martin?
Okay, the last question. That's a bit of a doozy. Wow. I've really been exploring that lately. I think what I loved about stand-up was the fact that you can just go up and do it and do whatever. All you need is yourself and funny jokes. And I liked the variety of voices and styles and how the patterns that you could see, but how everybody kind of had their own different thing. And lately I've been a little frustrated with stand-up because it feels like people have a very limited idea of what it is. A very specific homogenous idea of what stand-up is. And I'm hoping that there are more unique voices that are really starting to pop out and sound a little bit different, and people are willing to not just see stand-up as this one particular thing, but as more of a concept of over. It was inspiring to go to these arts festivals and seeing like, oh, there's like different ways to do this. And then seeing like, really great club comedians sets, and then right after go to this like weird like artsy like clown show where this or this like one person show where they're doing a story. It's a very inspiring. I like a variety, and I hope that comes back. That would be nice.
More of a performative element to stand up versus a lot of different people having a very similar sounding voice in what they talk about.
I mean, and not just not. I don't want it to then just be performative. I want it to be everything, and I want everything to kind of be. I want a sampler platter every time I go to a stand-up show. I don't want kind of like the same people who are inspired by the same people. You know what I mean?
I do. I also wonder this, and maybe you can tell me. I'm sorry, I told you last question, clearly not the last question, because I do have one more question for you. Because I mentioned that it feels like a comedy bubble is forming in Austin, but you look nationally and I guess internationally too. There are so many new specials coming out every week. Does it feel like there is a comedy bubble forming to you in New York? And if so, does that lend itself to more people who are trying something a little bit different standing out from the crowd?
I mean, I from what I've seen, it feels like there's almost an oversaturation at the moment. I think a little bit more of an emphasis on getting the special out than making sure that the special is something that is, in its name, special. But that's also a little bit of a cynical little hoity-toity view that I have that I'm trying to temper and make sure I'm not just being so up my own ass about things and trying to be like, okay, maybe I'm not looking hard enough or I'm ignoring willfully, or I'm trying to get a little bit better about balancing out. But I also hope that other things balance out because I've a lot of people who I really like and respect share in these frustrations. And I think the wheel always kind of continues and turns. And yeah, there are a lot of specials. There's a lot of podcasts. Maybe let's scale it back just a little bit. And then, or maybe, yeah, there's going to be so many that really the only ones that can possibly stand out are unique and different and interesting. I don't know. We'll see.
Yeah, podcasting has muddled things a little bit. And I also think that way too many comedians try and model their ability to turn material over from those who do it really well, like Louis C.K., who for a long time was
Yeah.
coming out with a new special every year. I mean, he is a unique comedic mind. There are only so many people that can work that fast.
Totally. Absolutely. Yeah, like it's and the TikTok of it all, the you kind of get you get a lot out of churning,
Yeah.
and sometimes I think instead of just churning things out, it might help to kind of, work on it and build and take it to the anvil and hammer it, and take your time with it. But it just, little quantity over quality. I don't know. These are all kind of questions that are swirling around right now. And I've been trying to explore in therapy, which I just started going to.
Congrats to that. Yes, social media is such a double-edged sword for stand-up because it can build or it can create new fans and build more of a fan base. But at the same time, you can potentially burn material, but also it's almost like you empower people who are in the crowd to try and become a part of the show in the process because a lot of what gets released on social media is crowd work. And so therefore, some jackass who doesn't know any better thinks it's their right to pay a ticket. And once you pay for that ticket, you can say whatever you want to or yell out whatever you want to during the show to become a part of the show versus recognizing that even at its foundation, when it's just spoken word, it is still a performance art. You need to let the person on stage do what they have planned for weeks, months, years, or whatever.
Totally. And some people, really thrive with that, like, crowd work style of thing, but it's almost hard to I mean, of course, I blame the person who's just shouting out at a show that they paid a ticket for, just really not understanding kind of what's going on. But at the same time, I don't fully blame them. I'm like, they're looking at these videos, and they're like, yeah, this is what's funny. It's like the audience and the performer participate. I'm like, I get it. That's what they're learning.
Look,
It's
I
not great, but
watched
that's what they're
in
learning.
yeah, in the last year, I watched two of your New York City colleagues, Sam Morril and Mark Normand, perform separately at the Paramount. And they're obviously really good crowd work guys who have made more of a name for themselves with that. But to watch people shout out when they give people the chance to do show at the ends of shows, it was embarrassing. Like how many people were trying to scream stuff out. And they're basically just looking back and forth because it becomes this cacophony of random terms or words or ideas being thrown out there that they're supposed to do something with. But that's also the bed that they made for themselves, I guess, by being so good at it.
I mean, exactly. Yeah.
So, all right. Well, Martin, thank you so much for the time today. Martin Urbano is going to be here at Moon Tower Comedy Festival this Sunday at the State Theater, 7 and 9:30 shows. And he is recording his special. It is abstract, it is dark, it is twisted, it is beautiful. Highly recommend you check it out. The bits and pieces that I've heard him talk about or actually seen on social media, yes. Well worth the price of admission. You can go to ParamountAustin.com. Excuse me. You can go to austintheater.org to check out more info or to grab tickets. Martin, thank you so much for the time. Safe travels to and from Austin this week.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thanks to Gentleman Jesus for the intro and outro music. Hear more of his work at gentlemanjesus.com. And thanks to you for hanging out. More of the show and to connect on social media, visit booksonpod.com. We'll talk to you next time on Books on Pod.